I mean, and it's rooted in the system. If we were meeting next year and the campaign is underway, now I don't care whether it's McCain, I don't care whether it's Barack Obama, whether it's Hillary Clinton. I don't think the two parties are clones of each other. I think people's lives in the United States in concrete ways are better under the Democrats than the Republicans in terms of Social Security and other matters. They're not equal to each other. But when it comes to maintaining the empire, just look at history. Just start with World War I and Woodrow Wilson, okay? That I would argue that in the 20th century, that the Democrats as warmongers and empire builders, I would argue the Democrats had a tougher team. I'll take Woodrow Wilson, FDR, Truman, Lyndon Johnson, and Jack Kennedy as my basketball team. Okay? I'll give you, you know, I give you what, Coolidge, Harding, you know, yeah. I mean, I'll give you any five Republicans you want, and I'll take the Democrats.
What about Theodore?
Well, yeah, even starting, I mean, before Teddy Roosevelt, and again, you know, the image of Teddy Roosevelt going up San Juan Hill, which he really didn't, as an ardent conservationist, but Teddy Roosevelt was a virulent racist and imperialist of the first order. I mean, it's not that U.S. presidents before that, because when we went back, and those of you remember when we talked, when we were using Zinn's book, this imperial surge really started under George Washington, okay, the first president of the United States. I mean, the original imperialist struggle was against the existing independent nations. We call them Indians, indigenous people who were here. But if you move more toward the real, the argument is the real U.S. empire and imperialism really emerges with Teddy Roosevelt and the Spanish-American War, misnamed the Cuban War of Independence, the war against the Philippines. From then on, over the last, well, it's a little more than a century. That's why I love that quote. He said, you know, there are no imperialists in the U.S., just expansionists. But he's right. He's right. I mean, the country has been expanding and expanding. You know, it's like this big balloon, man. Just keep...
Are you saying you take Woodrow Wilson over any Republican?
No, in terms of imperialists, because I think the image we have, for those of us especially who grew up in democratic families or considered ourselves as we were growing up to be liberal Democrats or progressives, is that the Democrats were much more of the progressives. And there was progressive legislation under Woodrow Wilson, which he took credit for, but which was fought for from the roots up. But we were never taught the other side, same way with Kennedy, that we're talking about an aggressive militarism in the world. And I think when you, you know, when you look at Grandin's book, you're going to be staggered by the amount of material that involves John F. Kennedy. The early rise of the national security system in Latin America, which led to the death squad regimes in Guatemala, in El Salvador, in Nicaragua, in Argentina, in Brazil, Uruguay, are all traced to the efforts of McNamara, of Kennedy, of Bundy. I mean, those are the real roots. It's not that nothing...
Not Eisenhower?
Well, yes, before, but I mean where it became so institutionalized, I mean, really begins with Cuba, you know, where Kennedy, especially after the U.S., and it was a U.S. invasion of Cuba, it wasn't Cuban exiles, it was a U.S. invasion, crushed at the Bay of Pigs. Kennedy has, frankly, crudely, a bug up his ass, among other things, about Fidel. And we have the documents, and I'm going to actually quote extensively from two recent volumes I've read just on Kennedy's foreign policy. It's extraordinary. I mean, it's extraordinary because the mythology of Kennedy is so out there that even to this day, people who are progressives and leftists just, well, oh, if John Kennedy had been alive, whoa, you know, he wasn't Richard Nixon, you know, that miserable son of a Nixon, ooh, God, and, you know, but it's incredible. And so Wilson, even FDR, and Williams has an interesting critique of FDR, Truman especially, because that's where the national security state starts, under Truman, and the attack on the left in unions, and the Red Scare begins not with Joe McCarthy in Wheeling, West Virginia, in February 1950, holding up, you know, I got 200 names, and dropped to about 12 at the end of the evening. It starts with Truman. And the argument made by some historians is you had to crush progressive movements in the United States in order to really have imperialism abroad. And that's why dissent here in the U.S. is absolutely critical to keep alive, whether it's in the Democratic Party, outside of the Democratic Party, because they can't do anything they want to do abroad if there's real resistance here at home, as well as what Brian talked about. The real resistance, of course, is what's happening in Iraq. So
I think that the U.S. established the U.N. as a vehicle to express its power and control the world, and some of the little countries are running amok, and they can't control them. So that's my take on the United Nations. It's not functioning the way we expected it to. We have to act like it's supposed to be a democratic institution, but we never intended it to be. It's like the United States itself. And as far as the resistance, because if you look at the history of these people, they're ancient, they... And Rashid Khalidi, I was trying to get the name of his book. He came to Midnight Special, remember?
Yeah, yeah.
They drove the British out. The British gassed the Kurds. They drove the British out of Fallujah. I mean, you knew it was going to happen. Everybody should have known.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people did.
But the other thing is, with the book, with William's book, I would really like to see, in addition to this political analysis, more of an economic analysis, because that would be where everything begins and ends. And just to cap it all, when we talk about minimum wage, I think we need a maximum wage, and then we would end all this problem.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think it was Franklin Roosevelt. And let me clarify, I mean, you know, there were many fine and progressive things came out of the New Deal, mainly because they were fought for by working people, by quote-unquote minorities. I think Roosevelt, at some point during his administration, proposed 100% tax on incomes above a certain amount. And, of course, it was dramatically less. I mean, you're talking now, what, 70 years. And he was hated by some members of the capitalist class. Others who were more farsighted realized that he helped save this system. But, yeah, a maximum tax so that, or maximum income so that you wouldn't have this guy who just got dumped at Home Depot. He gets dumped, and they're giving him $200 million as a buyout. Your comment, though, about Williams, I mean, he spends quite a bit of time talking about the power of corporations, the kind of system we have that is so productive. It's one of the contradictions. It's the most productive system in terms of turning out things. Forget about, you know, having homes for people. The LA Times had an article that they did a very systematic count of homeless people nationally, 744,000, which would make that community one of the probably top 20 cities in the United States. There are very few cities in the United States above 750,000. There are about 10 or 11 that are above a million in terms of the actual city population. So we have a system that's amazingly productive, that has hundreds of billions of dollars invested abroad in factories and in speculation, and yet, of course, it can't be invested here at home to produce the kind of society that technically we know we can have. So I think he discusses that.
No, I was talking more about the interplay between the politicians, the front men, and the puppets.
Oh, okay. Well, I would just disagree in a comradely way. I think some clearly are front men and are puppets. Some of the, you know, people I mentioned, like Paul Nitze and then Dean Acheson and Clark Clifford, are genuine members of the American upper class who go in and out of government and, quote, what we call private life. You know, they go to work for corporations, they come to work for the government, and who both hold economic and political power and hold economic power even if they don't have, they're not in office. For example, David Rockefeller, who was sort of the patron saint of Kissinger. Kissinger worked with the Rockefellers. So it didn't matter. David Rockefeller didn't have to run for office. In fact, it may have been Zach. I think Zach told the story that, you know. Gore Vidal tells the story that somebody, I think David Rockefeller, said to Nelson Rockefeller when he was going to come run for office, I mean, you don't have to do that. We have people to do that. You know, Nelson Rockefeller was involved in public service, you know, as far back as FDR's administration. I mean, he was very active and, of course, became governor of New York. And actually, it was under him that my university grew dramatically, the State University of New York. And he was known as a liberal Republican, but they knew the Rockefeller brothers and others in terms of their investments. They were powerful figures to make decisions to try to shape this post-World War II world to really create order, because if all of these little countries, forget about the Soviet Union, but after World War II, I mean, so the Soviet Union's out of bounds. The U.S. could trade with it, but they can't dump a lot of surplus capital and commodities there. But all these other areas, if they start opting out of this system, we choke on all this surplus. So that's why Cuba was so dangerous in this hemisphere. I mean, regardless of whatever you think about internal Cuban policies and freedoms, lack of freedoms, if other countries followed Cuba's example, as Venezuela seems to be doing, then they will make, it's not that they're, you know, they're going to refuse to trade with the U.S. I mean, Venezuela is one of the largest oil suppliers to the United States, by the way. So it's not that that's not going to happen, but they'll determine what's done in their country. It won't be determined on Wall Street or Washington. And if that happens, can more and more countries, our economy is in big trouble. Big trouble.
I just wanted to get back to the issue of the United Nations. And I'm curious whether, looking back from, say, the overthrow of the Arbenz government in Guatemala, especially all the interference of the U.S. in Central America in the late 80s, were there any times in which the U.N. took issue, public issue, that had some effect, some impact on all the brutal, the
School of the Americas
type training and so forth? Were there any times at which the United Nations really stood up and confronted the U.S. on this?
Well, going back to Kit's point, I mean, there are two parts of the U.N. There have been consistent anti-American resolutions in various agencies in the U.N. and in the General Assembly on U.S. position in the Middle East, I mean, very critical of Israel, condemning the invasion of Panama, U.S. position on nuclear weapons. One of the latest votes wasn't the landmine treaty, it was something, there was a vote a few weeks ago in the U.N., it was 157-1. I mean, even Israel didn't support the U.S. So in the General Assembly, which has no real power, but it has important power in the world in terms of influencing world opinion. It's not an irrelevant body. In the Security Council, well, of course, remember, some of these actions of the U.S. were covert. I mean, nobody knew. In Arbenz, it was 54. And Arbenz essentially was, he would be like a New Deal Democrat, okay? And United Fruit, who's, of course, connected to the Dulles brothers, and Alan Dulles was head of the CIA, and John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State at this time when they overthrew Arbenz. And Arbenz said, well, this is what United Fruit tells us the property's worth, and so we're willing to pay you what you declared as your taxable property. And they went, quote-unquote, batshit. So the U.N. couldn't, that was covert. Of course, the Iranian overthrow the year before. I don't know. You know, I'm trying to think whether the U.N. has blocked. The U.S. went ahead, of course, with the invasion of Iraq. It would not have been able to get another resolution through the U.N. in 2003. But I think ultimately, especially now with this regime, it will do whatever it needs to do without the U.N. I don't know, honestly, I'd have to go back and look at the record, whether the Security Council has been able to block any U.S. aggression, certainly in this hemisphere. But maybe there's somebody with the it could be brought up. You know, Jack's got a good point. It could be brought up and people, well, we're going to condemn the United States for the invasion of Panama or whatever. Or if people knew ahead of time, we're going to block this. Well, yeah, U.S. has got a veto. So, yeah, think of it. Panama, Grenada, Chile. Most of the things going on against Chile were a secret, but were known, certainly in Chile and elsewhere.
I enjoyed reading this book. You know, it seems like every time they wanted to do something, they were very good at cooking up an excuse, you know, rationalizing something or provoking people, you know, like in the Philippines or in Cuba and in North Korea, they didn't even ask Congress to. And I'm thinking of all these different presidents. They all sort of did a lot of acting on their own, you know, without Congress or whatever. FDR did it in World War II also. I mean, attacking the Germans and doing all this stuff to provoke Japan, you know, that brought the public to think that we're being attacked when really it was something that we set up to make it look like we're being attacked. And so this brings us right up till today, which is, you know, we've got an executive power that's just gotten all this power. And Bush is saying that, you know, he doesn't care. He'll do whatever he wants to. You know, when 70% of the people don't want it, it doesn't matter. Some people think this is a policy of attacking Iran, that they're trying to provoke Iran right now, and that the Israelis will be provoked into using bunker busters on Iran now. if Bush and company just take it upon themselves to do this, because we're in this position where we have $4 trillion of debt and all kinds of other problems, the only way the U.S. economy is going to survive and control globalization is to control the Middle East for the oil, the raw materials, and globalization to keep Russia, China, and everybody else from doing it. So
I think you were leading to a question about executive power.
Yeah.
That it seems to me, especially after I quoted some of the things from Johnson's book, and this goes for both Democrats and Republicans, that increasingly, especially since FDR, right, the last declaration of war voted on by the Congress of the United States was December 8, 1941, after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. There has been no declaration of war since then. There have been resolutions. Now, people who are elected to Congress take an oath to defend and preserve the Constitution of the United States. Article 1, Section 8 says very clearly, Congress shall declare war. It doesn't say Congress shall declare resolutions. The founders were very, very clear. And you're absolutely right. Under both Democrats and Republicans, increasingly, we do not have, remember we learned in school about checks and balances. We have three equal branches of government, and we have the judicial, and we have the executive and Congress. So here's Bush, who wouldn't know the Constitution if it kicked him in the mouth, saying that he basically can do whatever he wants to do. But here you have Joe Biden, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who's a lawyer, and he doesn't know about the Constitution. Because under the Constitution, Congress holds the purse strings. Congress can undo the resolution that passed in October 2002. Congress can do all sorts of things. There's the Cooper Church Amendment from the Vietnam War. There are all sorts of things that Congress can do. Money originates in the House. Bills, which same way the Congress can demand, now it's not going to be upheld by the judiciary, because they're part of this scam. Congress can demand that every bill, by the way, under the Constitution is supposed to be public. So we're supposed to know all the money that goes into the quote-unquote black box. Well, we don't know. So just being a conservative today and saying, okay, we have a constitution, we're supposed to have a constitutional form of government. You want to send troops into Iran? We already have troops in Iran. You want to do this? You want to have a war? It's a war. Then you declare the war. You vote for the war. You tax people. That's what you do. And that, I think, over and beyond the tragedy of all these wars and the lives lost, I think Johnson's point is the destruction of what minimal constitutional democracy we had is so frightening that whomever becomes president, even if it's a really progressive, decent person, is caught up in this institutional power and will act and cannot go to the deliberative body, okay? You could understand it maybe. You could make an argument. Someone attacked us immediately and we've got to respond, etc. But that, of course, wasn't the case in Panama or Grenada or Iraq. So let's have a real debate. And if we should go to war with Iraq, we don't pass a resolution giving the president authority, which Congress cannot do constitutionally. The problem is, and here's the dilemma, no court, and certainly not in my lifetime since World War II, no court has blocked the ability of the president of the United States to act as he wishes on foreign policy. You have a totalitarian regime. The Supreme Court consistently refused to rule on the legality of the Vietnam War. Justice Douglas, William O. Douglas, was willing to do that. They will not touch it. Federal judges will not touch it. So there's no way within the system to stop what is clearly tyrannical power. And that's the dilemma we face as a people. And so that's why I'm saying, make Barack Obama president. He wants to beef up the military. And my argument is, for the ruling class, what more brilliant stroke could you have than make an African-American president who's going to go kill black people in Africa and other people in Iraq and Iran, and he'll do it. He'll do it. And a lot of liberals are going to roll over. Well, you know, he's for inclusion. His inclusion is killing people of color around the world. And I don't know the way out of that dilemma, because I'm expressing my frustration, but Laura had her hand up.
Hi. Okay, let's suppose that I am the greedy, capitalist, United States imperialist pig that I am. And let's suppose that endless war is necessary for my well-being. But is it necessary for me to win every war for my well-being? Or am I going to continue to grow even if I don't win wars? Maybe it is necessary to win. So how am I going to win? Do I institute a draft? Or would it be smart of me to be a little less greedy and maybe cut a deal with some European powers or with India and give them some stake in my winning a war? Or is that just impossible for the system to do? I mean, the system wants to survive, and I totally believe that there's some very smart people that will ensure that it does survive. Is their own greediness going to undercut them, or are they going to wise up and realize, well, maybe they need to spread the wealth a little bit?
I think yes to all of those parts of the question. I mean, we know from U.S. history that greedy people in power, some of them recognized that some things had to change during the New Deal for reforms, to reform the worst aspects of the system to preserve it. And it's not an abstract system. It's people in power who want to maintain their power. That happened during the Progressive period under Woodrow Wilson. It happened with the trust issue with Roosevelt. There have been times in this society that the worst abuses, child labor, it's the development of Social Security, women's rights, other kinds of things, had to be done in order to maintain the sanctity of the system. Now, when it comes to wars, I think it may have been that one article we read by John Bellamy Foster. Yeah, the U.S. will cut deals. The leaders of the U.S. will cut deals with the leaders of India, the world's largest democracy, where millions of people live like beggars on the streets, and who knows how many people literally starve to death in the world's greatest democracy, where they're untold millionaires. I just finished Mike Davis's book, Planet of Slums. If you really want to read a depressing book, you know, when you think of what's happening in cities like Mumbai and Jakarta and et cetera. So it's in the interest of U.S. rulers to cut deals with people there in China, Russia, and anywhere to maintain the system in which they all profit. But at the same time, certainly Felix Green and others would argue, they have to maintain our interests first. It seems to me to be pretty sensible that they would want to crush any kind of insurgencies that arise, that they would have preferred a quick war as they found in Grenada or Panama to what they're facing now, because billions of people around the world are aware of what's going on in Iraq. That's why the Vietnam example was so powerful. It gives other people in the world the incentive to resist as well. But they can't control that. I mean, no one can say no one. Wilfred Burchett, who wrote for The Guardian, predicted early on that the Vietnamese resistance would stop the United States. Noam Chomsky, of course, who was a vociferous critic of the Vietnam War, actually differs with other anti-war people. He argues the United States did not lose in Vietnam because it so devastated the Vietnamese society, ecology, that it's going to take generations for it to be repaired. But they stopped a complete U.S. victory, as we had in World War II. So that's going to continue. And, you know, since Vietnam, the U.S. has not picked a war with any country that could possibly give it the resistance the Vietnamese or the Koreans did. Yet there is a resistance in Iraq.
They thought they could, they didn't, but they did.
Because, let's face it, the United States maybe killed 200,000 Iraqi soldiers in the first Persian Gulf War. The U.S. led U.N. sanctions in Iraq, maybe killed 500,000, 600,000, 700,000 children, absolutely devastated that country. In terms of an actual battle between armies, there was never any question that the U.S. was going to win that quickly. But other people, probably Khalidi and others, knew that based on Iraqi history that you were going to have a resistance.
Same in Afghanistan.
Right, right. And it's... And it may not be the kind of resistance you like or we like in terms of it being these wonderful progressive people, because some of them are absolute monsters if they get control of their own country. But that's not a decision that we have a right to make. You know, if people attacked this country, if the position were reversed, and there were lots of white Aryan monsters from Idaho and Wyoming resisting legitimately, we might not like those people, but they have a right to defend their homes. I mean, we can't say, well, we got to have a pure group of people who are going to resist. There's no such thing in the world. And it's going to continue. I mean, I don't know how it's going to end. Every empire has gone down, so I don't know how long this one will take.
Everybody considers this administration to be crazy, and I think there is a method in this madness. I think the key word now is oil. the Earth is running out of energy, running out of resources, and this administration knows it. And they'll fight to the end to get this oil. What's interesting is, and everybody says that there's a limit to their power, I don't think they cannot take over Venezuela. And as you said, the difference is, if they go on Venezuela, what will be the reaction? They lose all Latin America, and Latin America is progressive. If, when they go to the Middle East, who reacts there? Who fights them? Fanatic Muslims. They can always demonize them. It's very difficult to demonize progressive forces in South America. It's very hard. The European already accept this lie about Islam fascism. It will be very difficult to convince European about South America, because even they know something about the history of American intervention. Now, I'd like to make another point regarding the Soviet Union. At the time, the Soviet Union and United States actually divided the world. There was a small Soviet empire and a big American empire. And they knew this is their sphere of influence, this is their sphere of influence. United States never would have reacted, never intervened when the Soviet crashed Hungary or Czechoslovakia. Vietnam was another story. The Soviet never interfered in South America. The exception was Khrushchev when he installed the missiles in Cuba. And as he wrote in his book, my purpose of doing it was to ensure to withdraw and to ensure that the United States will never attack Cuba. And what happened eventually, he paid for it. The Soviet leadership didn't like it. The Soviet leadership threw him out shamefully because of what he did. But it was the only exception of the Soviet Union balancing the power of U.S. imperialism. And now another thing about this administration, the difference, I think, that because of the oil, because of the fear of shortage of energy, they're becoming, in a way, more aggressive than all other administrations. And a good example will be with Israel. All the previous presidents put some mild pressure on Israel to make peace with the neighbor, its neighbors, with the Palestinians. The Bush administration puts pressure on Israel not to make any agreement. Yeah. Syria was offered Israel peace, and most of the members of the Israeli cabinet were ready to accept it, and Olmert told them, Bush is putting pressure on us not to make peace with Syria. The same is about the war in Lebanon. Israel failed after 3 days, and Gondoliza Rice told them to continue. Yeah. Now they put pressure on Israel to attack Iran. So I think they are not crazy, but I think the fear of losing the oil is so powerful that the policy seemed very irrational to many people in the world.
Amen. Charles, why don't we let you finish up?
Two things. One, to go back to the United Nations, one of the ways the United Nations was designed was that it's hamstrung in a certain respect, which we're seeing in Darfur right now, which is that the way the U.S. empire has worked is that it's worked within countries. It doesn't usually work overtly against countries, and so it's not usually seen as an aggressor. It uses the own ruling elites within the country, supports them militarily, and uses them to crush the people of their own country. And it's written into the Charter of the United Nations that they're not allowed to intervene within the political affairs of a country, so they can't intervene in what could be seen as a civil war, only with an aggression between nations. Knowing that that's the way it was designed, the U.S. takes full advantage of that. And you could argue, I suppose, maybe that it was intended from the beginning in that way. The other thing I wanted to mention was that I don't know that this is true, but my cynical hat that I put on at times makes me look at this world affairs and think of it in terms that religions and nation states are really fictions that ruling elites use to police people of lesser means, to manipulate them in ways to their advantage. And they're working with each other across national boundaries. You can see this all the time. And as long as they can keep a war going and they're profiting from it, why end it? I forget whether it was one of your lectures, John, or in the movie Why We Fight, that somebody said that they went to Johnson. He admitted to them privately. He said, I can't stop this thing because my friends are making too much money. I want to stop it, but I can't because my friends are making too much money. And then Eisenhower's statement that God help the person who sits in this chair that knows less than I do about the military. And there's one more thing about the interconnectivity. If they're willing to see a war go on, as long as they can keep making armaments and selling them, making money off of that, and we need more soldiers, well, we'll lower the requirements. We'll institute a draft if we have to, maybe, but we'll give them $50,000 for college and then make sure they get killed in combat or disabled or whatever. And if they'll do that, then why would they not sell this country completely down the river into a total depression? I mean, I'm sure they can make money off of that too, you know? So I just don't see that it's conducive to look at it in those nationalistic terms anymore.
The concrete reality is we do live within a nation state. And I think one of the things I draw from William's book and other readings is that there's going to be resistance outside to the U.S. empire, whether it be in Venezuela, whether it be in Cuba. Now people are saying, well, you know, Fidel's very sick. Is the U.S. going to take advantage of this? Well, maybe, but you have an island of 12 million people, of which millions are armed. They have a modern army. They have modern planes. And if the U.S. thinks it has trouble with people in Baghdad, believe me, just try and take on the Cubans. This is not Panama or Grenada. But the real issue is whether the people here in the United States are going to become informed in order to resist the ideology and hegemony in order to block some of this. Otherwise, it'll be back to Orwell's 1984. There'll be endless wars, and that will continue. And this enemy, remember, used to be China, and now China is our friend, and then it used to be this. Iraq was our friend, Saddam was our boy, then he was a monster, he became Hitler. As my students who never heard of Saddam, in August of 1991, or 1990, the next month, they all knew Saddam was Hitler. Okay, a month before they entered that class, they wouldn't have known who the hell he was on the face of the earth. They couldn't find Iraq on a map. So it's what happens here is worldwide in implication. Let's go home.
You have been listening to Empire as a Way of Life, a lecture and discussion series given by Dr. John Marciano. This group meets monthly until June of 2007 at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the Internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots, social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org.
Back when I first heard about homeschooling, it was generally regarded as the province of extreme religious fundamentalists who wish their children to remain ignorant. The general view was that children who were homeschooled were denied the benefits of socialization with other peers of their age. But there's a new homeschooling movement called unschooling, and John Taylor Gatto is one of its main advocates. Gatto taught for 30 years in the New York City public schools, and what he came to conclude was that the educational system was not, in fact, improving children's minds, and furthermore, it did not seem structured to do so. The children that were being put through the educational system showed a lack of self-confidence, inability to think critically, and thus that were petty, vicious, and easily manipulated. Gatto set out to examine why it was that a system supposedly designed to improve the minds of Americans seemed to be having the opposite effect. He plunged into a decade-long project of research and uncovered the documentary proof that the intentions behind the founders of a compulsory school system in America had very different goals. This week we begin Chapter 12 of Gatto's magnum opus, The Underground History of American Education. He's titled this chapter, Daughters of the Barons of Runnymede. And he begins with the membership requirements from the charter of an organization called the daughters of the barons of Runnymede. Membership in the society is composed of women who are of legal age and lineal descendants of one or more of the 25 barons selected to enforce the Magna Carta, those barons in arms from the date of King John's coronation until June 15, 1215. Membership is by invitation only. Within the society, there is an Order of Distinction committee composed of members who trace their ancestry to Knights of the Garter, Ladies of the Garter, and Knights of the Bath. Close quote. In the founding decades of American forced schooling, Rockefeller's General Education Board and Carnegie's Foundation spent more money on schools than the national government did. What can a fact like that mean? Because they possessed a coherent perspective, had funds to apply to command the energies of the ambitious, possessed a national network of practical men of affairs, and at the same time could tap a pool of academic knowledge about the management of populations held in the universities they endowed, these and a small handful of men like them commanded decisive influence on forced schooling. Other influences had importance, too, but none more than this commitment of a scientifically benevolent American ruling class whose oversight of the economy and other aspects of living was deemed proper because of its evolutionary merit by the findings of modern science. The burden of this chapter is to show how a national upper class came about, what was on its mind, and how schools were the natural vehicle it mounted to ride into a scientifically humane, thoroughly utopian future. At the end of the 19th century, an explosion in the creation of exclusive hereditary societies took place which couldn't have been predicted from the course of the American past. These peculiar clubs constituted the most flagrant leading edge of a broad-based movement to erect nothing less than a coherent national upper class whose boundary was drawn in bloodlines. This might be better understood as an early manifestation of the genetically charged environment of American life at the advent of the 21st century. This social enclosure movement produced orthodoxy factory schooling for the masses as one of its very first policy thrusts. It produced the licensing phenomenon, which echoed the traditional right of English kings to confer a living on some loyal subjects by reserving good things for them which are denied to others. We've been wrestling with many other aspects of class and caste-based government and society ever since we came out of this period. Evidence that this movement was organized to concentrate power within a Brahmin caste stratum is caught by the sudden ostracism of Jews from the ranks of America's leading social clubs in the decade and a half directly following Herbert Spencer's visit to America. This was far from business as usual. Jesse Seligman, a founder of New York's Union League Club, was forced to resign in 1893 when his son was blackballed by the membership committee. Joseph Gratz, president of the exclusive Philadelphia Club during the Civil War, lived to see the rest of his own family later shunned from the same place. The Westmoreland in Richmond boasted a Jewish president in the 1870s, but soon afterwards began a policy of rigid exclusion. The University Club of Cincinnati broke up in 1896 over admission of a Jewish member. The point is, whatever was wrong with Jews now hadn't been wrong earlier. Who was giving the orders to freeze out the Jews and why? The striking change of attitude toward Jews displayed by Bostonian blue blood and author Henry Adams is a clue to where the commands might have originated, since the Adams family can be presumed to have been beyond easy intimidation or facile persuasion. Adams' 1890 novel, Democracy, illustrated the author's lifelong acceptance of Jews. Democracy featured Jewish characters as members of Washington society, with no ethnic stigma even hinted at. In 750 intimate letters of Adams, from 1858 through 1896, the designation Jew never even occurs. It suddenly shows up in 1896. 38 years of correspondence without one invidious reference to Jews was followed by 22 years with many. After 1896, Adams seemed to lose his faith entirely in the Unitarian tradition, becoming then a follower of Darwin and Spencer, a believer in privileged heredities and races. H.G. Wells, The Future of America, published in 1906, called attention to the transformation the English writer witnessed on a visit to this country. Quote, "The older American population," said Wells, "is being floated up on top of this immigrant influx, a sterile aristocracy, above a racially different and astonishingly fecund proletariat." Close quote. That fecundity and racial difference dictated that a second American Revolution would be fought silently from the Atlantic to the Pacific about a century ago, this time a revolution in which British class-based episcopal politics emerged victorious after a century and a quarter of rejection. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. All through the British colonial history of America, the managerial class of these colonies was drawn from Church of England gentry and aristocrats. As you might expect, this leadership shared the British state church's creative distaste toward education for the underclasses. And underclass then was a term for which the customary narrow modern usage is quite unsuitable. Every class not included in the leadership cadre was an underclass. The eye-topped pyramid on the back of our $1 bill catches the idea of such an episcopate beautifully. Divinely appointed intelligence ruling the blind stones beneath. The episcopal rule of British America is well enough documented. Yet it remains largely unremarked how many revolutionary leaders were still communicants of the Church of England. Russell Kirk estimated 29 of the 55 delegates attending the Constitutional Convention of 1787. They may have been willing to push the mother country away, but their own attitude toward popular sovereignty was ambivalent. Little known even today is the long private effort of Ben Franklin to introduce British royal government, to displace the Quaker Penns of Pennsylvania, and take command of the state. Between 1755 and 1768, Franklin labored mightily at this, reluctantly abandoning his dream and jumping ship to the revolutionary conspirators just in time to save his own position. After Braddock's defeat, Franklin joined forces with the influential Anglican priest William Smith in a venture they called the Society for Propagating Christian Knowledge Among Germans Settled in Pennsylvania. Close quote. This association, a harbinger of government schools to come, had nothing much to do with reading and counting, but everything to do with socializing German children as English. Braddock's defeat on the Monongahela was the straw that tipped America's influential Quakers into the Anglican camp. It joined two influential, socially exclusionary sects in bonds of mutual assistance. When the great explosion of elite private boarding academies took place in the late 19th century period, when hereditarian societies were also forming and for the same purpose, Episcopalian schools made up half the total of such schools, a fraction many times greater than their denominational share of population would have warranted. They still do. And Quakers at present, just 1/2600th of the American population, 0.04%, control 5% of the inner circle of elite private boarding schools, many elite day schools as well. This constitutes 125 times more participation than bare Quaker numbers would seem to warrant. A managerial class was circling the wagons, protecting its own children from the epic social conditioning yet to come, and perhaps from the biological menace Darwin and Galton had warned about. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. How the decisive collaboration in which Quaker men of wealth, felt driven by circumstance to seek protection from the established Church of England happened in the months after Braddock's army was cut to pieces on October 16, 1755, is a fascinating story. The western frontier of colonial America promptly exploded after the British defeat. Delawares and Shawnees attacked across western Pennsylvania, burning all forts except Pitt. By November, they were across the mountains and the Susquehanna, and in January, the whole frontier collapsed. Settlers fled, many running until they reached Philadelphia, almost crazy with anxiety. Scots-Irish Presbyterians on the Monongahela blamed their trouble on rich Philadelphia Quakers controlling the legislature who had prevented levies for frontier defense. An unauthorized Presbyterian militia hastily assembled, the notorious Paxton Boys, whose columns proceeded to march on Philadelphia. I can hardly do justice here to that lively time, except to remind you that Pennsylvania to this day is divided east-west. The net upshot of Braddock's fatal hauteur was to send Scots-Irish Presbyterians on the warpath against Quakers and to drive important Quaker interests into Tory arms for the protection from their fellow Pennsylvanians. Thus, at the very moment, British authority and rigid class attitudes came into question for many Americans, conservative Quakers, conspicuously wealthy and in control of the mainstream press, became its quiet proponents. "I could wish," said Thomas Wharton, for whose Quaker family the business school is named at Penn, "to see that religion, Anglicanism, bear the reins of government throughout the continent." In the exact decade when Americans were growing most fearful of the rise of an American civil episcopate, these friends, quote, "cheered the news of the growth of Anglicanism," according to Jack Marietta, the Quaker historian. So the dominant seeds for a delayed Anglican revival were buried in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware soil, right from our national beginnings, and Philadelphia. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. These buried seeds sent up no more stunted shoots until the late 19th century, when skillfully induced mass immigration, cheap Catholic labor by the boatload, triggered a perceived need for emergency social action on an Anglican model. At that moment, casting about for a blueprint of order in the disturbing period of mass immigration, the new industrial and commercial elites discarded existing American models. The tentative intellectual meritocracy of the Unitarians, the rude nepotism of the Presbyterians, the libertarian democracy of the General Baptists, the proud communitarianism of Congregationalists and Quakers, the religiously centered communities of the Pietists, all had to give way since all were both local and particular forms. None could accommodate a general habit of rule from afar very well. None was able to maintain tight enough class discipline. Congregationalists were closest to this ideal, but even they had radically weakened their own theological discipline with a halfway covenant and then thoroughly liberalized themselves in the Second Great Awakening after 1795. None of these forms would do as a universal blueprint of stable government. Only one acceptable discipline had for centuries proven itself under fire, able to bend diverse, distant, and hostile peoples to its organization, and that was the Anglican Communion. In India, Africa, Asia, Canada, wherever the British flag flew, it had been capable of the hard decisions necessary to maintain a subordinated order and protect the privileges which accrue to those who manage the subordinate classes. Peter Cookson and Caroline Purcell cast a great deal of light on the Anglican temper in their book Preparing for Power, America's Elite Boarding Schools, particularly the turn-of-the-century period, which saw the creation of almost all of the 289 boarding schools that matter. Quote, "The difference between a public school and an elite private school is, in one sense, the difference between factory and club. Public schools are evaluated on how good a product they turn out, and the measure of quality control is inevitably an achievement score of some kind. But to compare public and private schools in terms of output really misses the point, close quote. Cookson and Purcell, searching for reasons to explain the need for total institutions to train the young, concluded, quote, "The shared ordeal of the prep rites of passage creates bonds of loyalty that differences in background cannot unravel," close quote. Collective identity forged in prep schools becomes the basis of upper-class solidarity and consciousness, but sharing alone will not preserve or enhance a class's interest. As a group, members must be willing to exercise their power. The preservation of privilege requires the exercise of power, and those who exercise it cannot be too squeamish about the injuries that any ensuing conflict imposes on the losers. The founders of the schools recognized that unless their sons and grandsons were willing to take up the struggle for the preservation of their class interests, privilege would slip from the hands of the elite, and eventually power would pass either to a competing elite or to a rising underclass. Private school students are enlisted as soldiers for their class. Like Viking rowers, tough, loyal to each other, and ready to take command without self-doubt. Cookson and Purcell say currently, quote, "Boarding schools were founded not to produce Hamlets, but Dukes of Wellington. The whole point of status seminaries is the destruction of innocence, not its preservation," close quote. I hope this illuminates those esoteric membership requirements of the daughters a bit. Whatever your personal outlook on such matters, you need to take seriously the creation of over 100 new hereditary associations, associations with all the birthmarks of secret societies, which gestated and came to term in the decades from 1870 to 1900, or just outside that narrow compass, each designed that it might, in a perfectly orderly, fair way, free of any emotional bias, exclude all unwanted breeding stock by application of hereditary screening, and at the same time concentrate biological and social excellence. In the same time frame, 5 of the 7 sisters, the female Ivy League, opened their doors for the first time, concentrating the future motherhood of a new race for its class inoculation. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. In Darwin's second most important book, The Descent of Man, the fate in store for those liberal societies which will allow mongrelization of the racial stock was made clear. They would fall prey to the ruthlessly even-handed workings of evolution and evolve through reversion. The lesson of descent was not lost on Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, or San Francisco. In one brief instant, the rationale for a caste system was born and accepted. No merit system ever after could seriously breach the hereditarian barrier any more than it could budge the, quote, scientific, unquote, bell curve barrier. A biological basis for morality had been established. One of the 100 new hereditarian societies, all survived, by the way, was the Aztec Club of 1847, cherishing those who participated in the Mexican War as commissioned officers and their descendants. The Aztec Club actually anticipated the intense hereditarian period by a few years, and so may be considered a pioneer. Had you been a, quote, Aztec at the founding dinner in 1880, you would have been at a table with President Grant and Jefferson Davis, as well as a fraternity of names engraved in legend. Presidents Taylor and Pierce and Generals Lee and Pickett were dead, or they would have been there, too. The Aztec Club of 1847. Not a single public school teacher of the nearly 3 million in the United States has ever been on its rolls, I'm told. Are we in the presence here of some higher truth? The Society of California Pioneers was another of these new hereditarian bodies which came to exist in the narrow zone of time just before effective mass compulsion schooling. This particular society celebrates, quote, those memorable pioneers whose enterprise induced them to become founders of a new state, close quote. I don't think you ought to summon up a mental picture of some grizzled prospector to fit that enterprise. Leland Stanford's family better fits the bill. Here's a baker's dozen of other outfits to allow you to see more clearly the outlines of the new society rising like an English phoenix out of the ashes of our democratic republic. And he lists them: the Order of Americans of Armorial Ancestry, the Society of Mayflower Descendants, Society of Americans of Royal Descent, the Daughters of the Utah Pioneers, Women Descendants of the Ancient and Honorable Artillery, the Order of the First Families of Virginia, the Order of the Crown of Charlemagne, the Order of the Three Crusades, 1096 to 1192, the Descendants of Colonial Governors, the Society of the Cincinnati, the Society of Founders of Norwich, Connecticut, the Swedish American Colonial Society, the Descendants of Colonial Clergy. The popular Leviathans of this confederation of special blood were the National Society of the Sons of the American Revolution, which enrolled 11 of the next 12 presidents as members. Nixon was eligible but declined, and its sister society, the DAR. The yeast of Latin, Slavic, and Celtic immigration falling on the dough of Darwinianism provoked the great families of the United States into building a ruling caste with a shared common agenda, a program for national and international development, and a schedule of social regulations to be imposed gradually on the future. If you can't deduce that program for yourself as it employs mass schooling, you might wish to write the Society of the Cincinnati for enlightenment. The sudden appearance of these associations, excluding from membership all non-Aryan immigrants, provides us with a sign this new caste had consciousness of itself as a caste. Otherwise, development would have been more gradual. It marks a great dividing line in American history, as the hereditarian wave rolled up the beach. Even you could have designed the schools it was going to need. One thing missing from the utopia of diverse hereditarian groups which were gathering, the scientific racists, the private schools, clubs, churches, neighborhoods, secret societies like Bones at Yale or Ivy at Princeton, special universities which served as a later stage in the elite recruitment and production cycle, etc., was a grand secular myth. Something less creepy than a naked assertion of successful protoplasm climbing up biological ladders out of the primordial slime was necessary to inspire the exclusive new establishment that was forming. Some stirring transcendental story to complete the capture and inspiration of the ruling class mind. Such a thing had to be found, and it was. The creation myth of American caste would appear unexpectedly in the form of an ancient language uniting the powerful classes of the United States into a romantic band of spiritual brothers, a story to which we turn next. And I'm afraid I'll have to leave you with that cliffhanger because we're out of time for this week. I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education, and if you want to find out what that language was right away, you can read his book online at his website, johntaylorgatto.com. And you can contact me and download this show at unwelcomeguests.org.